A week ago today, my dear mother died. She was such a generous, loving, kind person. And I think sometimes it's after someone dies that we appreciate that more fully. It's easy to take people for granted when they're alive. So though her death was quite expected, had been coming for many years of decline with Parkinson's disease. Still, that moment of finality, knowing I'll never see this precious person again, this person who gave me this body, amongst other things. So it's unspeakable, really. I think the gratitude and depth of connection with this particular person. So naturally, I've been thinking about her a lot in the last week, and also thinking about death a lot. When a close one like that dies, it brings it to the foreground, right? The mystery of death, and therefore the mystery of life. They go together. That's what I'm finding this week, is that opening to that mystery of death opens me to the mystery of this life. And all religions and spiritual traditions around the world, from so long back, right, from before history, people, I think, were wondered about this mystery of life and death, and what happens after someone's gone. I've never heard of any religion or spiritual tradition that doesn't have some teaching about afterlife. Something happens after death. The only religion I can think of, actually, I think there's one that I can think of that doesn't have a teaching about that, and it's maybe the dominant religion in America today. People might not claim to be followers of this religion; they might claim to be followers of other religions, but deep down inside, maybe most people, I don't know, speculate, maybe most people are followers of this kind of new religion called scientific materialism. Science, basically, but I think maybe some quantum physics realms of science are starting to go beyond the materialistic view, but I think most physics and science up to very recent times is materialistic in the philosophical sense. Materialistic means reality, the bottom line of reality is material, and anything called mind or consciousness is derivative of matter or material. No one's quite sure how mind or consciousness could derive from matter, namely like brain cells and electrical activity in the brain. No one's quite sure how that, exactly how those meet. And I think that they will never be quite sure exactly how those meet, at least from a materialist point of view. And so in the sense that if every other religion has some version of an afterlife, then maybe in some ways every religion has some aspects anyway that aren't materialistic view. Or it's kind of mixed, you know. You can have a materialist view like this stuff of the world is truly material, it's made of matter, and then there's a consciousness or a soul or something that's immaterial that survives the body. Many religions have that. That would be kind of a sort of a mind-matter dualism. And even some Buddhist views have early Buddhist teachings are a little bit like that. Later Buddhist teachings kind of try to resolve this issue by saying that what we call matter isn't really material. It's more like mind stuff, which actually, as a theory, is maybe more kind of neater. It works more neatly than mind-matter duality. So naturally, with my mother's death, I'm thinking more than usual about is there anybody left there? And now talking to her, you know, maybe a year ago, sort of casually trying to see what she thought about these things. What do you think happens after you die, Mom? And she'd say, I think it's just like falling asleep and never waking up. I think, you know, we grew up Christian, but I think my parents leaned towards the scientific materialist side, even if they never heard the term. A lot of skepticism and doubt about religious ideas of heaven and hell and so on. And therefore, it's not so important to my dad, for example, who loved my mom so much and it's a really difficult loss. It's not so important, like, to relate to some spirit after the person's gone. When they're dead, they're dead. Of course, the memory of the person and is lives on. That's, you know, materialists can be fine with that part. Or we just, maybe there's some kind of heaven, but we'll have no way of knowing and relating to that, relating to the person on their way there or whatever. So just let's not bother thinking about such things. And it's true that scientifically we can't really prove one way or the other, really. If there's some continuity of anything in terms of consciousness after death. But I think it is good to remember that there's absolutely no scientific evidence for a nothingness after death. Even if we might not find strict, measurable, materially measurable scientific evidence for something after death in terms of consciousness, there's no evidence for nothingness. So I've been, of course, doing many Zen ceremonies for my mother relating to any kind of consciousness that might be lingering around, which is the teaching in all schools of Buddhism. Trying to relate to her. I have my doubts myself, right? As someone who's really thought about these things a lot and studied the teachings a lot, because we can't really prove these things, right? But the more I look into it, the more I feel like the teachings of rebirth and other possibilities for after death in Buddhism make more and more sense, kind of logically or rationally to me. They make more and more sense. They make more sense than nothingness to me. But it takes some contemplation, and people might come to different conclusions. So in addition to many Zen ceremonies that I'm doing for my mother, today was a seventh day for, there's Buddha's teaching in most schools of Buddhism propose that there's this 49-day maximum period in between lives, in Sanskrit called antarabhava, like a between state, between birth into another human, animal, heaven or hell realm, all these impermanent realms of birth, that there's a space between waiting for appropriate conditions, anywhere from 7 to 49 days. So even in the Zen tradition, we have every 7 days, up to 49 days, we call on different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to help protect and guide this, what is it, this, we could say a stream of moment-to-moment, subtle conscious moments. We say that in Buddhism there's no continuous self or soul in terms of an entity that's reborn. Even in, while we're alive right now, there's no entity like that. But obviously we will wake up tomorrow, we feel as if there's some continuity with yesterday's person. In terms of cause and effect. Let's say individual cause and effect. We don't wake up as some other person. There's a connection between these conscious moments that are connected with memory and the effects of our actions and so on. And you know, very complex and almost inconceivable kind of ways. And yet, this moment has some dependent relationship on the previous moment's consciousness. And there's no reason to assume that cause and effect series just ends at the moment of death. After all, scientists would agree that the law of conservation of matter in the world of matter and material, nothing's lost, it's just transformation, taking other forms. But since science is mostly concerned with matter, it doesn't relate to that same type of law of conservation of energy in terms of consciousness, because you can't really measure it with our usual scientific instruments. So in addition to Zen ceremonies, I've been also reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead to my mother. I also really appreciate this tradition. It's another way of relating, and a beautiful way of relating to, very similar actually to these Zen ceremonies of 49 days. So there's this translation of this, basically it's what's read and conveyed to this being during these 49 days. There's a reading for each day. And this is translated by Robert Thurman, a great Buddhist scholar, professor, and practitioner. I really appreciate his introduction here. So he begins here, "What is death?" I'll just read a few passages from this that I thought just really struck me. What is death? The question is a scientific one. Western science holds that a flat line on the EEG means cessation of heartbeat and brain activity, and therefore represents death. The instruments to measure physical material things, right? Like heartbeat and brain activity. The illusion of the subjective I, or me, in the individual consciousness assumed by materialists to correspond with the presence of brainwave activity should cease with the cessation of brainwaves, according to science. Yet the picture of death as a nothing in consciousness is not a scientific finding. As I mentioned before, science can never prove a nothingness, right, after death. It can prove that there's a flat line on the EEG, but that's not about consciousness, right? So the picture of death as nothing in consciousness is not a scientific finding. It's a conceptual notion. There are many cases of people being revived after flatlining for some time, and they report intense subjective experiences. I think many scientists would be skeptical about their subjective experiences because they're subjective experiences. And yet, all cultures, there's stories of such experiences. I think it's interesting that he's sort of reversing the way we usually think of things. I think scientists would say, these ideas about rebirth or heaven or hell or afterlife are conceptual fictions. But here he's saying the idea of death as nothing in consciousness is a conceptual fiction. It's a conceptual idea. It's nice to, it helps us. I mean, you know, secretly, I confess that I have some of this scientific materialism view in my own being. I was raised that way, with science and rationality. It's very convincing in so many ways, right? So I like to study, since I'm a disciple of Buddha, I like to study the Buddha's teachings that kind of deny this view that I may behold sometimes, consciously or unconsciously. I like things that challenge my habitual views. Even if they're not necessarily right, I like to be flexible with my deeply held views. So, do people know Pascal's wager? I think he lived in the 1800s, and it was, you know, as a Christian, it was about whether if we don't know if God and heaven and hell exist or not, it might be good to like take the chance that they might and act as if they might, because a lot could be lost if we didn't, and there's not that much lost if we don't, something like that. So here's Robert Thurman's version of this Pascal's wager. I think it's nice the way he puts it. He says, for even the most die-hard materialist, Pascal's famous wager is still compelling. If we become nothing after death, we will not be there to regret having prepared for something. Like having wasted time preparing for something, right? But if we are something after death, and we have not prepared at all, or are badly prepared, then we will feel bitter, painful regret. So we have everything to lose by not preparing and nothing to gain. We have everything to gain by preparing and nothing to lose. This is Pascal's wager. Should our preparation be for nothing, a little time spent on it in this life will not be regretted for eternity. Should our preparation be for something, the time taken away from it for the sake of this life's business or pleasure will be deeply regretted for eternity as the waste of a vital resource. So those of us who have either the prudence or the adventuresomeness to deal with a life situation of total relativity in space and time can safely proceed. This is us, that we're not just an individual separate I, actually. We're living in this total relativity or interdependence in space and time. There are no boundaries to our interconnectedness with limitless dimensions and universes, and there are no limits to our continuity of development, bad or good. So we might say, well, our preparation for death, if there is something, would be to be kind and compassionate and generous and wise person in this life, which doesn't have so many bad side effects, right, in this life either. So luckily they go together, right? And I'd say, well, you know, how far do we take this kind of thing? How far do we want to develop in this life to create the effects in a future one? Thurman goes on. Given the boundless interconnectedness of living forms, beginningless and endless, and spread throughout an infinity of space, the materialist picture of evolution as natural selection operating purposelessly, yet efficiently, developing life forms through random mutation from a definite beginning point within a finite theater of planetary environment needs some revision. It's not like it's a wrong story of Darwin's evolution, but it's a materialist story. It's just talking about material evolution. And it's the purposelessness. I think Darwin's pure theory of evolution would say it's just dependent arising. It's just happening this way. It's not set in motion for some particular purpose. He says, first of all, postulated definite beginnings and finite settings are always suspect. You know, that there was a certain time on Earth, this planet, before which there was no life, and then this particular year and moment, what we call life, began in these tiny organisms. Whereas Buddha Dharma speaks more of like beginningless life and endless life. The materialist account describes reasonably the material causal development process, but why should not mind as well as body develop and mutate? Because it's hard to study it with material instruments. The Buddhist view of all this, the psychobiological evolutionary account known as the theory of karma, is very like the Darwinian idea of evolution. Interestingly, it's not the same, right? It's talking about development of mind, but it's similar. He says, once beings become conscious of this process, however, they can purposively affect their evolution through choices of actions and thoughts. Although there are undeniable differences between karma and Darwinian evolution, the karma theory gives an evolutionary explanation of how beings are the way they are. So I have translated karma in this book as evolution or evolutionary action. Quite a creative translator just to put it that way. Usually karma literally means like intentional action, but he's emphasizing the evolutionary aspect of it. how sentient beings can evolve over a lifetime and over many lifetimes through their actions and their understanding. Sometimes people say that, I've heard this story quite a bit, and they're, you know, looking into some articles about this, I think it's a common view that people say, well, the Buddha's teaching of rebirth was just a kind of a skillful means, because everyone in Buddha's time already, in India at that time, it was the dominant view of rebirth, so the Buddha didn't really necessarily exactly believe it, but he kind of went along with it as the popular view, partly so the rest of his teaching would be accepted, and it wouldn't disturb people too much. But interestingly, when you look into the tradition, as a lot of these scholars have done, we know what was going on in India at that time. It's amazing, actually, how much was recorded about different philosophical systems and practices going on in 500 BC in India. But it turns out that there was the view of karma and rebirth in the Upanishads, for example, before the Buddha's time. But it was not the dominant view. There were a lot of other views of what happened after death, including materialist views. And even in the Buddha's sutras, he talks with various materialists, or they're sometimes also called annihilationists, which means that if you believe there's really nothing except this material body, when it dies, consciousness is annihilated, or it's just cut off, because consciousness goes with the physical body. They didn't even know about a brain, I think, in those days, but that they thought that's it for consciousness, that person's consciousness. So the Buddha debated those materialists and others who believed in an eternal afterlife, eternal heavens and hells in Buddha's time. And some had the view of rebirth. Usually, in their case, rebirth was the rebirth of a individual self, sometimes referred to in English as like a soul. Some sort of continuous being. So the Buddha tweaked that a little bit, because he taught there is no continuous entity, individual entity, that continues forever. But beautifully, the Buddha's teaching of rebirth fits perfectly into his teachings of not-self and the teachings of dependent arising. I think any other teaching might be hard to fit into the, if we say that dependent co-arising is a universal teaching about everything arises dependent on other conditions, then it seems to me, the more I contemplated, that any view other than rebirth would have a hard time fitting into the teaching of dependent arising, actually. I have heard many people say a somewhat reasonable theory, Buddhist theory of dependent arising, is that we don't know if this consciousness, this conscious stream of moments, is reborn, carrying its particular karmic effects of this person, and so on. But the karmic effects of this person do play out in the world after we die. We do know that our actions continue in the world after we die, and we do know that there is consciousness in the world after we die. But there, people say there might not be a connection in a sort of individual streams kind of way. So that's worth considering, I think, that view. Could still fit with dependent arising, but one thing that it misses is is feeling like there's some sort of like more Bhikkhu Bodhi, when another contemporary teacher has a really nice article about this, where he's looking into these issues, and he says, it's, without this teaching of rebirth, it's hard to account for what he calls moral equilibrium or moral justice, and because we feel, he claims, that most people feel on some really intuitive level that there is some sense, that there is or should be some sense of moral equilibrium throughout space and time, and that, say, and that is not accounted for in an individual life. So, like, somebody could do a lot of extreme harm, kill many people, you know, and actually have a kind of comfortable life of denial. Maybe they'd eventually start feeling not so good about that, but I think we know examples. People could be in extreme denial, cause a lot of harm, and feel like not so much regret. We know of many examples like this. We hear about it in the news. And then there's stories of people who do great beneficial things and have lives of selfless generosity, and they and meet with great misfortune, are killed young or whatever. Right? So that's like, we can't account for this moral equilibrium in the course of one lifetime. It doesn't play out, and we say that, and that feels off to us. But this this teaching of rebirth kind of accounts for that. The Buddha says the karmic effects will come in a later life, in a later moment of this series of body and mind, particularly consciousness, in a future lifetime. And even Dogen Zenji, our Japanese Zen founder in the 13th century, has a whole essay on this karmic continuity across lifetimes to account for this moral equilibrium. And also there's various problems if we do away with the rebirth teaching, at least from the early Buddhist perspective. Rebirth is, it's not just a little thing tacked on to Buddha teaching. It's woven through all these early sutras. And in fact, the whole teaching of what liberation from suffering is all has to do with rebirth in the Buddha's early teachings. It's all about ending that cycle of suffering, rebirth. If there was the materialist view of all suffering for this person, for this stream of consciousness, this stream of conscious moments, if all suffering were to end at death, that's the materialist view, right? Consciousness is cut, and if there's nothingness, that would be total liberation. So if we take, at least looking at the early Buddhist model of liberation, everyone would realize complete liberation from all suffering at death, and therefore the fastest way to complete liberation would be suicide, like as soon as possible. Even if we're having an okay life, complete freedom from all suffering would best be accomplished by suicide, which the Buddha did not teach at all, right? It makes no sense, but that would be an implication. I think that's one that's really good to consider for skeptics, like I am sometimes, about rebirth, is that the whole system starts to fall apart. I think maybe modern Americans are not into this total liberation from suffering. We're just trying to have a better life in this life, which is a valid intention, to be sure, right? But the early tradition of Buddhism is not just about kind of maximizing our samsaric life. So And then the Mahayana, the later Buddhist teachings, there's all these other possibilities besides birth, rebirth into the human or animal or heaven or hell, temporary realms. There's also the possibilities of being born into these pure lands where they're actually not in the in these six realms of samsara. But they're not Buddhahood either. They're like a launching pad where the conditions for practice are perfectly set up by Buddhas who made the vows to set up good conditions for practice. And one can more quickly become completely awakened in these pure lands and therefore be a Buddha, which is like eternally benefiting beings in the human realm and in the animal realm and so on. And there's possibilities to become, you know, a Buddha after death. And so in the Japanese Zen tradition and Chinese Zen, it's been interesting for me to look into that too. And of course, there's many people have tried, you know, putting together the pieces. At least knowing what the tradition teaches. So that's this model of rebirth was a 49-day period in between. I think the Theravada school of Buddhism says there's this instant. There's no 49 days between the death and the next birth, but all the other multiple later schools of Buddhism agree on this intermediate period. In ancient India, like before this idea of rebirth came, like in the Vedas, like 5000 BC, like way back, there was a view of eternal life after death. And people would make offerings to their ancestors after they died, food offerings and so on. And they would try to protect their eternal ancestors, and those ancestors would protect the living back. And in ancient China, as I understand it, there was a very similar view before Buddhism came of after death, there was like part of the being of that person, the kind of more heavy animal part would descend, and they called the yellow springs, kind of descend into the earth, and the lighter, more like spirit of the person would live eternally in kind of like a heaven realm, what we might call a heaven realm, and again the descendants of this ancestor would make offerings to this spirit, protect and be protected by, and they would make these, this goes way back before Buddhism, make these tablets, which now in Japanese we call ihai, we have some on the altar. So it's a board with the name of the deceased on it. And that's like the location for the deceased, eternally deceased spirit to come to receive offerings at, you know, some special times or really whenever. And people can keep that in their home and relate to the deceased in that way. Which is beautiful, I think. Just like every culture, I think, has some sort of located grave. So, talking with my dad today about what should we do with mom's ashes, you know, and it seemed like she wasn't so specific about her request there. She wants her name engraved on this family gravestone in Pennsylvania, but I think we're landing on scattering the ashes at sea because she loved the water, she loved sailing. But thinking with my dad about this, it occurs to me, it seems like every tradition likes to have some location, and ashes are the material part of a person that's left, and we like to locate them somewhere. Of course, the ocean is like a really boundless location, which is, I think, kind of nice that it's boundless, but you can't, I mean, you can go and make offerings to the ocean. I think that I'll probably do that actually, for my mother, if her ashes are in the water. But we like to relate to locations because we feel as if we're located beings. This is ancient human stuff. So I think it's beautiful to have these tablets. So then when Buddhism came to China, it's an interesting blend, and I bring up this story because maybe there'll be creative ways how Buddhism meets with American values and understandings and worldviews, maybe even science. And so the Chinese story again is that there's this, as I understand it, this sort of eternal heaven realm where these beings are living, and they can relate to them through these name tablets. And then Buddhism comes with this teaching of rebirth in 49 days. So they kind of mixed. And I think this was, you know, many, many, many centuries ago, Buddhism came to China. But I think ever since, up to present times, they keep this mix of something like these eternal ancestors, which you can make offerings to, along with the possibility of rebirth and this 49 days where you can make offerings and particularly guide that consciousness stream to a positive rebirth or better yet, a pure land or even Buddhahood itself. And it doesn't seem so contradictory. It's a little bit like Pascal's wager, as I understand this, like, well, maybe it's 49 days. If so, let's really do these ceremonies every 7 days, up to 49 days, and then we can stop those particular ceremonies because there's a birth somewhere. If they're in the hungry ghost realm, we continue to make offerings every year just in case they're in the hungry spirit realm. And if they're in the eternal ancestor realm, we'll make offerings there. So it's covering the bases. And I think it doesn't have to be so contradictory. I think Buddhism, as it evolves, has seen that this so-called eternal heaven realm could be seen as a pure realm, could go on for a very long time when the consciousness could be living in this beautiful, pure realm where they're working on practicing towards complete Buddhahood. They're not yet a complete Buddha, but they're working in that direction. Or they're a Buddha where we can relate to them eternally and they're actually benefiting us and all other beings in all kinds of conceivable and inconceivable ways. So it's a little silly that we would make offerings to them because they don't need it. We need offerings from them. But we have that feeling about them. So it's kind of complicated, right? These are some stories and, you know, more could be told. And But all these, for me, it's interesting, but now it becomes much more personal because this mother I love so dearly, these are ways of relating to her and the ways that our tradition has. And all traditions, I think, have some way. And maybe for my personality type, I'm always looking to clarify how things are, or at least my mind, it has to make some sense. And to me, these things make more and more sense, even though we can't prove them. The Buddha says, and I think it's the first verse of the Dhammapada in his very early teachings, he says, mind is the forerunner of all things. All things come forth from mind. So that's really so central to the Buddha's teaching. I think versions of nothingness and annihilation of mind make less and less sense to me. Do people have any questions or comments? Any of this? Yes.
Because I believe that, you know, we don't, no one really
Yes, and it may even be, one might look at it, at all these Buddhist stories as skillful means, because they all create ways of remembering the person, right? All these memorial services, every week, every month, every year, whatever, are ways of holding them in memory, because that is how they live on. So even just as purely, if we take it as purely skillful means, and we can secretly even be a scientific materialist and still completely honor that, the memory of the person. Totally. Yeah, an altar. Yeah.
That person, my entity. So that when I go to my altar, I can remember.
Totally. Do you ever make offerings to them at the altar?
Intense.
Yeah. Exactly. It's even said that in the ancient teaching is that in this intermediate 49-day state, that these beings are called Gandharvas, which means they, in Sanskrit, which means they, their nourishment is scent. They don't eat solid food, they live on scent. So I think that's one of the main reasons that incense has been used in the tradition, especially around memorials, for a long time. Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of, again, a gesture of relating to a location in an altar and giving something, offering something. Also, there's, you know, food and flowers and light and water. I think is a beautiful. It's a relational. It's a relationship, right, with that, with the memory of that person. And maybe there's more of a relationship than we can even imagine. Maybe they really are receiving our offerings and are very grateful for it. The other, yes.
It's coming to my mind of, you know, the ideas about form and emptiness and form, and yeah, is there a way we could look at what you're bringing up, like that, yeah, I mean, if it was form, it's only emptiness, you know, or essence or memory or relationship anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, it brings up the basic teaching of these two truths, right? Of the inseparable two truths, the relative or conventional truth of form, the appearance of life, and even the appearance of this moment-to-moment consciousness would still be considered the relative truth in Buddhism. And then the ultimate truth is that, as the Heart Sutra says, there's no form and there's no consciousness. And also, there's no rebirth. From the ultimate point of view, the ultimate teaching is everything is completely ungraspable and empty of what we think it is. So the Buddha actually says that this teaching of rebirth is a conventional, relative teaching. Ultimately, nothing actually happens. I think it would be problematic if we then say, well, rebirth's just a conventional teaching. If we say that, we also have to say this life is just a conventional teaching. So from the Buddhist point of view, rebirth is just as real as this body sitting here now. Just as real means conventionally appearing, but ultimately not really the way what we think is here. So they're equally. We can't pick and choose and say, well, rebirth's a conventional teaching, but this body is real, for example. That's picking and choosing, right? But the Buddha defined right view. Interestingly, this is just shows how central to his teaching and all the early Buddhist descriptions of right view in the Eightfold Path. Part of right view is the belief in rebirth. So I think it's not just sort of tacked on as a cultural accretion or something. And also the Buddha's enlightenment. He had this vision of all his past lives on that night. And also how the karma of all beings affects their multiple lifetimes. But you could say those visions were conventional, relative visions. They weren't the essential vision of what suffering is and the end of suffering. Yes. Mean like the 9/11 story might have been kind of like, if we do this.
There's been a lot of religions and like atrocities committed in the name of certain gods.
But particularly afterlife, let's stay with the afterlife. That's a good point. So that's why we could say from this Buddhist point of view, it seems the whole system of Buddha Dharma is kind of fail-safe if we really take the teachings to heart, because it's the rebirthing is all about karma, is determining the afterlife, is all determined by karma, and karma is clearly defined by the Buddha, not killing, not stealing, not misusing sexuality, not lying and false speech, so on. So I think there's no way, I mean, people I think will always find ways to misinterpret these teachings. I think that's a good example of misinterpretation, because you can't say that it's not killing. And I've heard that sometimes they would say, it's not killing because of this emptiness point, right? So again, if they say, again, it's like picking and choosing. If we say, that person's not really real, so we can kill them, well then also, your emperor is not really real, equally not real. From the point of view of emptiness, everything is equally empty. We can't say some people are empty and the orders from the emperor are not, right? So if we stay really true to the teachings, I think, but of course, we don't. It's hard to accord with the teachings. But I think the Buddha offers a system of pure benefit if we really take up the whole thing. And also with Pascal's wager, I think these are good points to consider. There's things that could go wrong through misinterpretation. But I'm also thinking about it now in terms of me relating to my mom. It's not exactly Pascal's wager, but sometimes I feel a bit like, God, is this funny to be relating to her like this? What about just, I'm also, remembering all the memories but all these ceremonies, and yet I feel like, doesn't hurt.
Couldn't hurt.
So it's time to go. I'll just leave you with, also sometimes people say, in Zen, there's not the teaching of rebirth, or at least, I think it's true, there's not much emphasis on it, but just to leave you with one teaching from our the Japanese founder, Dogen, the founder of our Zen lineage, in his essay called Mind of the Way, or Way-Seeking Mind. This is how to practice way-seeking mind. Part of this essay, he says, when you leave this life, before you enter the next life, there's a place called the intermediary realm, the Antara Bhava. This is, Tibetans call it, translated as Bardo. You stay there for 7 days. You should resolve to keep chanting the names of the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, without ceasing while you're there. After 7 days, you die in the intermediate realm and remain there in the next phase for no more than 7 days. At this time, you can see and hear without hindrance. That's why we can chant for them and talk to them, like having a celestial eye and ear. Resolve to encourage yourself to keep chanting the names of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha without ceasing. I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. After passing through this intermediary realm, when you approach your parents to be conceived, resolve to maintain authentic wisdom. Keep chanting refuge in the three treasures in your mother's womb. Do not neglect chanting while you're given birth. Resolve deeply to dedicate yourself to recite and take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha through all six senses as you're given these senses. It's kind of surprising to hear Dogen talking this way. Thanks for your attention and letting me explore some of these teachings with you all, and I will continue to explore them and consider them and try to understand them more and more deeply. And any positive merit and good energy that might have been gathered through our conversation this evening, I dedicate it all to the spirit of my dear mother, Carol Henkel. May she be sustained by our wholesome practice and be peaceful and free from all suffering through her passage, and open to the vastness of inconceivable love. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.